Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Andrea Weckerly, and welcome to the Ready Living Podcast, where each episode is designed to educate, inspire, and empower you to create the life you want. Thanks for joining, and remember to subscribe. My guest today is Dr. Samantha Montano. She is a disasterologist with a PhD in emergency management. She is an assistant professor of emergency management at Massachusetts Maritime Academy and has taught courses on a range of disaster subjects, including disaster preparedness, response, recovery, and mitigation, vulnerable populations, the political and legal foundations of emergency management, disaster communications, disaster film, and disaster nonprofits. She's the author of the book Disasterology, Dispatches from the Frontlines of the Climate Crisis, which was named one of the best books of 2021 by USA Today and one of the best science books of 2021 by Science Friday. She has written for or been interviewed by many national publications, including the New York Times, The Atlantic, National Geographic, USA Today, The Los Angeles Times, and has been published in The Washington Post, Teen Vogue, CityLab, and Vox, among others. She co-founded the Disaster Researchers for Justice Initiative and the Center for Climate Adaptation Research. Welcome, Samantha.
Thanks for having me.
I'm sure that people listening are wondering what a disasterologist is, so let's start there.
I have my PhD in emergency management, but there is a much, much, much broader range of people who are studying disasters from all different disciplines. And when I started doing this work and told people I was studying emergency management, they were like, "What is that?" So I kind of dug up this old term that had been mentioned in the literature, disasterology, and started using it. And I found that for the general public, it became clear pretty quickly what I was talking about.
You're a leading expert in emergency management, but years before you earned your PhD, you'd already gained firsthand on-the-ground experience in disaster recovery in New Orleans post-Hurricane Katrina, which you talk about in your book. Can you take us back to those early days in New Orleans and how that shaped your understanding of disaster recovery and emergency management? And while we're at it, for our listeners, can you also define what disaster and emergency mean in an emergency management context?
I grew up in Maine. And the worst disaster we really had when I was growing up was like the ice storm of 1997. And so compared to Katrina and the levee failure, just not the same thing at all in terms of impacts and need. And so I went down to New Orleans to volunteer, and I was just planning on being there for a week, you know, gutting homes, rebuilding homes. But when I got there, I was just completely stunned. The destruction, obviously, I'd seen it on TV, but to actually be standing there among miles and miles of debris, every single building effectively destroyed, it was just completely overwhelming. It just seemed like this real moment where all hands needed to be on deck. And so I decided to move to New Orleans, did my undergrad there, and worked on the recovery efforts for 4 years, doing kind of all different recovery work, rebuilding, helping with FEMA paperwork, insurance paperwork, all of the things that need to be done during a recovery. And while I was there, I mean, that was the first I had ever heard of FEMA before. I knew nothing about the emergency management system. And while I was in New Orleans, I had a very negative view of FEMA, very negative of emergency management, just given the failures of that system and the agency during the response to Katrina. And so I was kind of on this journey to try and understand what was happening. I went to some other disasters around the country. Because I was also doing my undergrad at Loyola in New Orleans, many of our professors had kind of altered their classes to focus on Katrina and the recovery from their own disciplines. Just happened to kind of be there at this very unique moment of like looking at Katrina through this more academic lens. Come to find out, you can study emergency management. And when I did that, one of the first concepts you learn about in emergency management is that not all disasters are disasters. We have some that are emergencies, some that are disasters, and then some that are catastrophes. The reason this matters is because the way you respond to these, the way you prepare for them is totally different. The way you respond to a 5-car pileup on the highway is obviously going to be different than the way we respond to a hurricane, right? And yet it all kind of falls within this spectrum. And so one of my like major epiphanies was realizing that Katrina wasn't wasn't a disaster. It was a catastrophe. It was this like next level of thing. And that really, once I started learning kind of the theory behind it, really helped me understand my experiences on the ground and kind of like why the recovery unfolded in the way that it did.
A lot of people, myself included, in the past used to think that emergency management mostly covered weather-related disasters, you know, floods or fires or things of that nature, but it's really broader than that.
Oh yeah, it's much broader. So we say we're all hazards in emergency management. So effectively, like any bad thing could potentially fall within the purview of emergency management. So that is things like, you know, when we have a major pileup on the highway and you have to reroute traffic. Emergency management is about coordinating all of the people who are to respond, right? And so anytime something happens that requires many groups and many agencies to be responding, emergency management is probably going to be at least behind the scenes. Car accidents up to terrorism, mass shootings, chemical plant explosions, all of the natural hazards. I always say if aliens show up, that's us too. You know, any bad thing you can think of.
Although if they're friendly aliens.
Sure, then maybe it's fine.
We just experienced Hurricane Helene and Hurricane Milton. Can you walk us through the process of how and when an event is declared an emergency for purposes of being able to tap into state and federal resources and what the order of steps are?
There's a whole bunch of different declarations that an event could get. For Helene, for example, which is maybe kind of a more traditional example, you have local governments may declare some kind of emergency at their level. And then a state will also usually declare an emergency. And then in terms of getting a federal declaration from FEMA, you can get an emergency declaration or a major disaster declaration. And process for that requires the governor of the state generally to request that from the White House. So the president is the only person who gets to decide if a declaration is being made. FEMA gives a recommendation, but it's ultimately the president's decision. And the reason that these declarations are important is because they open up different resources. They open up potentially different laws to help the response move forward. And so they're kind of a way to initiate a lot of these response efforts. Oftentimes, a declaration is made after a disaster has happened, if we don't have any warning. Every now and then, if we have enough warning for a major hurricane, for example, the president may declare a disaster ahead of time when we just know it's going to rise to that level. But there's a pretty strict order in terms of ensuring that the federal government's only becoming involved once local and state resources are overwhelmed. There are other declarations, for example, like through Health and Human Services for the pandemic. The EPA has some declaration granting authority for things like oil spills. So it is a little bit more complicated, but generally processes a governor requests it and then the president decides to grant one.
When it comes to assisting those in need after major events like we just went through with Helene and Milton, can you explain the relationship between federal and state aid? Like under what circumstances do state resources and or federal resources, including personnel, come into play?
We have a little saying in emergency management, which is that disasters begin and end locally. We really believe that it's the local community, the local government that should be first and foremost in leading response efforts and leading recovery, right? It's their community. But the very nature of a disaster is that those resources are going to be overwhelmed and help has to come in from the outside. And so that's where we start to see the state and federal government involved. State to state, emergency management actually can look pretty different. There are some states that have a much more robust emergency management system, like Florida. There are other states where it's lacking, I would say. And then you also have differences at the state level in terms of what resources are available. A state like California has significantly more resources, more money. So they're going to be able to do things like have these extra disaster recovery programs for individuals or certain populations of the state versus, you know, someplace like New Hampshire, where that isn't necessarily the case. There's some differences there. Generally, though, we have kind of traditionally thought in emergency management of the state as kind of being this go-between between local and federal and kind of being the overseers of the federal grant dollars that are coming into the state, kind of providing that more administrative support almost to local governments. I will say that post-pandemic, it does seem like maybe there's a bit of a change there, because during the pandemic, state emergency management agencies, along with the public health agencies, were given a much greater leadership role. It seems like maybe we've seen the light a little bit that the states could be doing more, but generally that's kind of how that relationship plays out.
I'm curious what you think the role of insurance or the lack thereof can play in people's ability to get back on their feet after disaster and damage to or loss of things like their home, belongings, vehicles, or small businesses. For example, flood insurance or wildfire insurance. Is that something people can obtain at an affordable rate? Because I'm thinking that with regard to Hurricane Milton, Reuters recently reported that insured losses could be in the tens of billions.
Yeah, so insurance is a really complex kind of sub-issue in emergency management. Oftentimes people think of insurance in terms of how it can be used to mitigate risk, meaning how can we use insurance as a tool to kind of change where people are living, move them out of these higher risk areas. Sometimes it can do that, but almost for me, the like bigger utility of insurance is, as you said, being the source of recovery funding. The way that our recovery system is set up, it's meant to have government be limited in their involvement. It's really dependent on individuals having insurance, and that being kind of the biggest pool of money that is available for people who particularly need to rebuild their house. And that is so great in theory. However, in practice, what we see is that we are dramatically underinsured across the country, like dramatically, cannot emphasize that enough. And that's true of flood insurance, it's true of wildfire insurance. So what we're starting to see, and what we have seen for a while, but it's becoming more extreme, is that when we have these major disasters, people are not able to rely on insurance for recovery. And then without anywhere else to go, right, people don't have like, you know, $100,000 just sitting in savings. And so they have to turn to government, which is being really limited in what resources they give. And it just puts people in this impossible position of trying to build. And so kind of in terms of solutions and like thinking to the future here, we have to just have more people with hazard insurance. Like more people need to sign up for the National Flood Insurance Program. It just has to happen. And there's some real barriers to that. Potentially, there are parts of the country where buying flood insurance is really affordable and it's no big deal for some people. And then for others, it's really expensive. Those costs are growing. There are parts of the country where wildfire insurance is no longer being offered. It's not even an option. So where are people supposed to turn to? We don't have a federally backed wildfire insurance program like we do with flood insurance. And then you have the homeowners issue on top of the homeowners insurance issue on top of this in states like Louisiana and Florida, where you start to like almost see a collapse there in some communities, which again leaves people in this kind of impossible situation. Even if they want it, you know, even if it to say, well, I can't get homeowners insurance, I can't get flood insurance here anymore, okay, I'm going to move. Who's going to buy your house, right? So without a government buyout, you don't necessarily have the option of leaving. So yeah, it's this incredibly complex issue. It's one that we need to figure out and fast. Currently, this is kind of been looked at a state by state and kind of hazard by hazard case. And I fear that we are at the point where we really need some kind of serious federal intervention here. And Congress is going to need to step in and try to come up with a solution.
Right now, there are tens of thousands of people affected by Hurricanes Helene and Milton. So what steps do they need to take to try to receive state and federal assistance? What are the things that people need to do, for example, to file a claim and document their losses? Can you maybe talk about the general process and what kind of documents and documentation they will need?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you are somebody who has had impacts from one of these storms, first and foremost, you need to document everything. Go take pictures, go take videos, gather any and all paperwork that you have, and then you'll want to start an insurance claim if you have insurance, and then you'll also want to start the process of FEMA assistance, individual assistance it's called, and if you just go to the website, you'll be prompted on how to start that process. And then once you kind of get into FEMA's system, there'll be other potential options like a loan from the Small Business Administration. Potentially, you may also want to be looking at your county and state emergency management websites if there are state level programs available or even local programs that are available. You should be able to find that information there. And then the other thing that I would keep an eye out for is any disaster nonprofits who are working in your community. It for housing rebuilding, it takes them a little while to get set up, but hopefully we should soon, if not already, see some of those bigger disaster recovery organizations coming in and making volunteers or other resources available. So that's kind of a place-by-place basis. So you gotta just kind of keep an eye out for them.
Right. You just mentioned the nonprofit sector. What role does that sector play in disaster recovery and what are its limitations?
The disaster nonprofit sector, again, kind of in how our recovery system is designed, is meant to fill the gap between what people can afford on their own and what government is providing. And so as we just talked about, that's a pretty big gap for a lot of people in a lot of places. Look, I love the disaster nonprofit sector. That's how I got started in this field. I have great respect for the work that they do. There is no possible way that they have the resources to actually meet all of the needs that we have in recovery that are being left unmet by government. And this has been a really big problem. I first started kind of documenting this and writing about this when I did my doctoral dissertation back in 2016 after some flooding in Southeast Texas. And I talked to a lot of the heads of our national disaster nonprofits, the volunteer coordinators for those groups. And they were all saying, you know, all the way back in 2016, think of how many disasters we've had since then. They were saying, you know, we don't have the capacity. We're dealing with volunteer fatigue. We're dealing with donor fatigue. There's just been so many events. We can't be everywhere at once. And that has remained the case since 2016, if not maybe a bit earlier. You know, they're having to pick and choose which communities they work in. It is harder, I think, these days to get disaster recovery volunteers than it was back when I was doing that work in New Orleans. There was kind of an endless supply of them, and that's not necessarily the case anymore. And then, you know, there's just the money issue of it all, right? The amount of money that is needed to do this kind of work is just massive, and it's hard to bring those kinds of dollars in.
So for people who have right now been impacted by what's going on by Helene or Milton, for example, or even other folks, what are some things you want people to know about personal safety after a natural disaster to avoid, let's say, post-storm fatalities? Like, what are some things that people need to be aware of in the first few days and weeks and maybe even months?
Generator safety is a big one, right? We still have a lot of people without power. Keep your generators outside. Do not bring them in your house. Just like generally being careful of, you know, you're walking through debris, right? You don't want to be stepping on nails that are sticking out of boards, those kinds of things. Wear thick shoes if it's possible. The next big one for hurricanes really is the mold issue. You know, anybody who's ever had water in their house knows how quickly, particularly in the warmer climates, mold spreads so fast. So as you know, as soon as you have your damage documented, that's kind of the all clear, you've got to start ripping out everything that has water in it, using the appropriate solutions to clear studs and, you know, all of that. It's really hard, right? Because so many people are displaced right now. There's not a lot of extra housing and places for people to stay. But if it is possible to stay somewhere other than your house that has flooded, it's really strongly recommended just on the mold issue until you can kind of be sure that everything has dried out. And then the other big one here, I would say, is the mental health side of this. We see that mental health issues increase post-disaster, right? Just the stress of the situation, the displacement, your social network is disrupted, right? Those supports that you might normally have. Maybe you were in therapy ahead of the disaster, now your therapist has been displaced, right? And so those existing supports aren't there. So if you have the ability to try and find mental health care, that is also highly recommended. There are some kind of disaster survivor hotlines that you can call if you're experiencing a mental health crisis.
And I'm glad you mentioned the need to get healthcare support. That is so vital. I think that's something we tend to forget when we're talking about emergencies, disasters, because we're so focused on the immediacy of physical survival that we tend to ignore the other part of it. But it's really a two-pronged need there that humans have. I also want to talk about social media and its role in emergency management. There was a 2023 article in the New Republic that talks about social media as an important means of being able to directly share information, and that X, formerly Twitter, is one of the most important crisis tools. And you're quoted as saying, "Twitter is in some ways democratizing how people are able to share information in an emergency. It's creating an opportunity for the folks who are a part of the formal response working in emergency management agencies and other responder agencies to capture information from people in all of these walks of life." You also said that a lot of what's covered by the media originates on X, noting that Twitter is where we very often learn that a disaster has happened. Specifically with regard to climate change, someone else wrote on X this past week that first-person accounts of the devastation caused by Hurricanes Helene and Milton are driving home on a very personal level what's actually happening in the words of those directly affected. Can you expand on the important role that social media plays in emergency management?
Social media has really come to affect all aspects of emergency management before, during, and after disasters. I think we focus on it most during an actual response just because of the kind of dramatic and life-saving nature of it. Twitter especially has really come to be used as this platform for survivors to directly highlight their experiences. It's a place where emergency managers and others who are responding are able to speak directly to survivors and to each other. And it's also, as I said in that article, a place where journalists are kind of looking for stories, able to connect with sources, which is a particularly challenging thing to do in the midst of disasters, you know, where everyone is displaced. And so for a long time, you could really go onto Twitter and see a second by second play-by-play of how a response was unfolding, assuming people had cell service, of course. Unfortunately, I will say that has changed more recently in these hurricanes, largely because of the changes that Elon Musk made to Twitter when he bought it. There has just been this onslaught of misinformation that has, you know, been able to spread extremely quickly and kind of unabated. A response at this point, or if it's doing kind of more harm than good, kind of seems like that's the direction that platform is headed in. There are also, of course, other sites. We see Facebook groups, especially you can find information about volunteer opportunities. You're getting life-saving information. We've seen people who need to be searched and rescued tweeting out their addresses. So there's all kinds of like potential utilities for social media during a response, let alone kind of on the front end in terms of the opportunities for public education.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the misinformation, disinformation, because I was looking at that stuff too, and I just couldn't believe some of the things I was reading. For example, the rumor that FEMA was blockading people in Florida and preventing evacuations. I mean, that's not true. Or that it was distributing aid based on demographic characteristics, when in fact, it provides assistance to survivors regardless of race, color, national origin, sex, sexual orientation, and so on and so forth. It was so bad that FEMA even set up a hurricane rumor response page that I would encourage people to go to rather than just widely believing what they're seeing. So yeah, this isn't just a question of false information being out there. It's a damage that's done when this stuff is spread crazily. I want to talk about one thing that people are often told to do in situations like hurricanes or wildfires, and that's to evacuate. And that sounds like such a simple solution to being out of harm's way, but in reality, it can be more complicated. In a 2023 op-ed you wrote for MSNBC, you said that in any disaster, the first question an emergency manager should ask is, why aren't they leaving? Can you share some of the reasons people don't leave? What can be done to handle the refusal of some who can evacuate and who don't, and the inability of some who would like to evacuate but can't when it comes to disasters like we just experienced? And what can be done to reduce this number in future disasters?
Yeah, you know, I think oftentimes when you're at home watching a hurricane head towards the coast and you see, you know, these interviews with folks who haven't evacuated, even though they were told to, you know, there's often a sentiment of, well, they're idiots. They should have left. They were told to leave. And to be clear, there are absolutely people who are just simply not listening and not doing what they're told. But it's much, much more likely the case when somebody doesn't evacuate that there is a very legitimate reason why they're not. So that could be anything from their, you know, they work a, you know, minimum wage job and their employer hasn't given them time off work. And so if they leave, they're going to lose their job. You have folks who simply don't have enough money to evacuate. Evacuation can be incredibly expensive. If you have like multiple family members and pets and you need hotel rooms and cars and gas and food while you're gone, right? There's all of these expenses that can start piling up. We tend to see that if a hurricane hits closer to the end of the month before payday, more people who don't leave, right? So really strong correlation there. You know, oftentimes people don't have cars. This is a particularly for within cities, this is a big deal. And, you know, sometimes people have like a medical issue. Sometimes even if you're in an evacuation zone, you have a particular medical need or something where going to sit on the highway in, you know, 90 degree heat for 2 days is more risky than trying to ride out the hurricane where you are. All of these different factors that are going into people's decision making about whether to evacuate or not. Something else that really came up, I think, during Hurricane Milton as well is when we say evacuate, we don't necessarily mean leave the entire state. I think we have that image of like everybody exiting Florida all at once, and there's other options. Certainly, Milton's impacts were covering most of the state. But even moving, you know, if you're right on the coast, even moving inland, you know, 10 blocks and going to stay at a shelter is probably going to be enough to where you're physically okay. In terms of like what we can do here to help with evacuations, one, I think we need to have a more nuanced understanding of what we mean by evacuation, right? It's not always this mass out of state evacuation. Sometimes it is evacuating inland to a shelter. And I know folks don't usually want to stay at shelters, but like that is often what we have the resources for, right? I mean, there's a million other things we can do, right? We can pass laws that say employers have to give their employees time off for evacuation. We can be handing out gas cards and giving gas away for free. So that people who can't afford it are able to access it, right? We can be doing much more. We saw some of this in Florida, but do more with like shuttles and using our existing public transportation to help folks get out who don't have cars. One, like I'll give a positive change here. After Katrina, one of the major findings of the research for why people hadn't evacuated is that they weren't able to bring their pets with them, right? Of course, who wants to leave their pets behind? I totally get it. So one of the things Congress did after Katrina was pass the Pets Act, which is about the need for shelters for pets and for shelters that can accommodate people bringing their pets. So if you notice, if you looked at any of like the sheltering websites during Milton, Florida has designations like this is a shelter where you can bring your pets, this one you can't. They also have like special like medical needs shelters. So if you have any unique medical issues, those shelters are better than like a general one. That's like a really great example where, okay, we've identified through research what the problem is here, and there is a policy solution, right, at the federal level, but also all the way down to the local level, where we can make these adjustments so that people are better able to evacuate.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned the pets, because that is one of the big reasons that people are going to be reluctant to go. They're part of the family. You've touched on this a little bit now in what we were just talking about reforms in disaster preparedness and recovery that we need to initiate. Are there some major key changes that you believe need to be made to build a more effective system? Are these changes at the financial, procedural, or political levels?
All of the above. Our emergency management system is like pretty good in the US, especially compared to some other places. I don't think that, you know, we're in a position to just throw away the system that we have. I think that we very much can make changes to this system to make it more effective, more equitable in how it's operating across preparedness, response, and recovery. In terms of what those changes look like, I do think they are pretty expansive. So because our system operates at all three levels of government, you really need changes at all three levels of government. And I always laugh because I think the federal changes are maybe the easiest here because you just have to deal with Congress, rather than the local changes and state changes where you have to go to every legislature and like city council to try and make these changes. So it's very like complex. And again, place to place looks different. I would say like the big general things that we could do pretty immediately to have significant impact would be, one, taking FEMA out of the Department of Homeland Security and restoring it to be an independent cabinet level agency as it was during the Clinton administration. That was where we saw FEMA kind of be most effective. It has more flexibility, independence. We can isolate it a bit more for some of the immigration issues that we've seen brought up with DHS this go around, right? So we got to kind of protect FEMA a little bit here and pull them out of some of the political stuff. We just need more money. And I know that is like the most boring thing, but we really just need to dramatically increase what we are spending on emergency management before disasters happen, right? So we spend billions and billions of dollars every year on disasters. The vast majority of it is going to our responses and our recoveries. And that's really that's necessary, but frustrating, because we know that for every dollar that we spend on mitigation, trying to prevent disasters from happening, we save $6 in response and recovery. Putting aside the like lives saved and whatnot, there's a huge economic argument here for spending more on the mitigation and preparedness side of things. That's true, again, at all levels, particularly, I would say, at the local level. We have across the country many communities that only have a part-time emergency manager, and they're being paid pennies to do this incredibly complex and important job. So if we want to incentivize the next generation of emergency managers to come into this field and get best and brightest into these agencies to do this work, we need to increase salaries. We need to increase the funding of the agencies, the resources that they have available to them. Yeah, so starting with some structural change in terms of where agencies are located, and then addressing the funding issue are kind of the two big starting points.
I've seen that you've written extensively that state legislators need to make sure they're funded adequately and that the profession needs to professionalize, so to speak. Is that what you envision when you're talking about professionalizing emergency management?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, these part-time agencies, a lot of the emergency managers are the fire chief who is, you know, playing double duty here. Those fire chiefs are great, but they're not trained broadly in emergency management. We talked about all the different hazards that emergency managers have to deal with. A fire chief isn't going to know how to handle a cyber attack. I teach it in an undergrad program. You can get a whole degree in emergency management. These fire chiefs largely don't have those degrees, right? They don't have that education as a foundation. And emergency management has been in this process of professionalization for many years now, and we've made great progress on it. You know, we have all kind of the building blocks of the profession, but I think the thing that is needed to really kind of push us over the finish line here is having the resources to support that profession.
In your 2022 TEDx talk, you mentioned that every disaster we will experience has already begun. What do you mean by that?
When we think of disasters, we tend to think of when the hurricane formed in the Gulf, and that is when the hazard formed. But the conditions that hazard is going to interact with actually create a disaster have been laid long, long before. Our development decisions across the country, where we are building, how we are building, where poor communities live in these high-risk areas where they haven't received the same level of funding for infrastructure. Those things make those communities more vulnerable when these hazards do come along. So you can go all the way back to like redlining, and you can see that it lines up where the higher temperatures are from the urban heat island. There are all of these policies, again, going back decades, even centuries, that have laid the groundwork for the impacts that we see during these disasters. You know, and this is also now true in terms of climate change and the fact that we're kind of, you know, even if tomorrow we flipped a switch and stopped, you know, burning fossil fuels, we're still locked in to a certain amount of change here. So these disasters have a much longer kind of lifespan than I think we traditionally think of them as having.
And it seems to me that until people are individually faced with this or their communities, there isn't enough of a groundswell of support to knock on the doors of legislators, for example, and say, well, wait a minute, we really need to make this happen. You know, if it's happening a couple of states down, particularly if it's a state that we don't really care about, it's one thing. But when it happens to our own communities, people are now starting to say, oh yeah, well, this is kind of scary. It is serious. And maybe we should start doing something about it.
One thing that's, I think, important to remember is that disaster survivors have more in common than they have different across the country, right? If you went through a wildfire, your experience is actually still very similar to somebody who went through a flood or through a heat wave. One thing that I think is really needed is for survivors to come together and organize across the country as one voice, because these are the folks who have the most direct experience with this. But unfortunately, just the mechanism for that organizing hasn't really come to bear. I do think that this is one place that the climate movement could be really effective, but they haven't seemed to want to take on the issue of emergency management reform to this point. Hopefully in the near future that changes.
Yeah, and that brings me to the next thing. I know that a couple of years ago in a Teen Vogue article, you talked about how the children's TV icon Mr. Rogers used to say that when a crisis happened, his mother always told him to look for the helpers. And in this article, you wrote that you had learned there were people, emergency managers, whose job it is to coordinate the responses to disasters, plan for them ahead of time, and so forth. But then you also learned, sadly, that this system doesn't always work very well, and we don't always get people the help they need fast enough, and some survivors never get all the help that they need. And then you talked about climate change, and you noted that we have to slow climate change itself, but we also need to prepare ourselves for what happens between now and then. And this means that we have to fight to mitigate climate change, but we also need to ready our communities to manage the consequences of climate change as the more extreme weather is happening. How can communities and individuals prepare for the slow unfolding of disasters driven by climate change? Because that's not going away.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there used to be a time decades ago where full focus on mitigating climate change itself, you know, dealing with this energy policy issue, was appropriate. But now we've crossed that line, right? Like, we didn't deal with it in the way that we needed to. And so now we kind of have to do twice as much work, right? We still need to be focused on mitigating climate change and preventing the climate from changing more. But now we also have to figure out how to live with the consequences of climate change that we are experiencing. And it's kind of the second piece, the consequence piece, that is the focus of emergency management, right? We don't have a ton of say over solar panels and windmills and those kinds of things. Our kind of area here is figuring out how we're going to adapt our community to withstand particularly these extreme weather events now. there's like good news and bad news there, right? The good news is that most of these hazards we're familiar with. We've dealt with hurricanes and wildfires for a long time. And so we have a lot of ideas about what it looks like to need to evacuate the coast or how to send out wildfire warnings. Elements of that are changing though, right? Like you see rapid intensification happening with hurricanes. That's a massive problem for us in emergency management because it means there's less time for us to do evacuations. And, you know, sending warnings for the fires in California is becoming more complicated because they're moving faster and are bigger and, you know, have these greater complexities in terms of like changes to fire behavior. Good news is that we're not starting from zero here, but kind of bad news here is that these hazards are changing and changing so quickly that we're having to really run to keep up. So in terms of what people and communities can do, I mean, it does kind of come back to just basic disaster preparedness that we've kind of always talked about, but it's now just, you know, you need more of it and it needs to be more important at the individual level, doing things like if you can afford it, making sure you have insurance, making sure, you know, that you have a plan of what am I going to do if I need to leave my home for an extended period of time? What am I going to do if I need to stay in my home for an extended period of time? I do think there's a lot we can do at the individual level to kind of protect ourselves and be responsible for ourselves as much as possible. But ultimately, when we're talking about these bigger events, you really need community preparedness. And that can look like a lot of different things. This does go back to like investing in your local emergency management agency. They need to have the money and the people to actually make all of these response plans and to actually have enough people to facilitate FEMA coming in for the recovery. You know, you need to make sure that your local, you know, your mayor, your city council are investing in updating your town's infrastructure. I know, again, not the most exciting thing, but we need to update all the drainage systems in America because of how intense the rainfall has become, right, to try and prevent flooding. I think it's really about almost even also just having like a mental shift of like reorienting ourselves to really thinking about what our risks are, what our community's risks are, and really start prioritizing our resources and attention and funding towards addressing those risks.
You wrote an article this spring called The Roots That Ward Off Disaster that was published in Issues in Science and Technology. Some of the things, for example, that are deprioritized are cybersecurity and other emerging threats due to lack of resources and legal mandate. You had shared how FEMA has been significantly understaffed with a reported 35% staffing gap in 2022. If you were able to address policymakers directly, what would be your most urgent recommendations for immediate action?
I know I keep bringing it up, but it really is funding, right? So for cybersecurity, for example, you know, we have emergency managers who just don't know what that means, right? And what all is encompassed there. Of course, we have plenty of cybersecurity experts in the country, right? We need to be connecting them into emergency management, educating our emergency managers. You know, at a certain point, especially if you're a major city, right, you need to have people on staff who are cybersecurity experts in the same way that in the Pacific Northwest, you have somebody on staff who's a tsunami expert. You know, if you talk to your average emergency manager across the country, you're going to see there's a very limited understanding and kind of the risk associated with the issue of cybersecurity. And that's true of these other hazards too. Even something like climate change is actually really complex. And if you are only a part-time emergency manager who graduated school 30 years ago, how are you learning about climate change, right? When do you have time to get that information? Emergency management just isn't a part-time job in the 21st century. There's too many threats. There's too many hazards. There's too much to be done. When you do have a part-time emergency manager, what you see is that they're effectively only checking the boxes that need to be checked to get the kind of baseline grant money from FEMA. They're not doing that kind of above and beyond, or also maybe bare minimum of doing mitigation, doing preparedness, you know, doing that kind of before side of things, which then kind of doubles back and means greater impacts when we get to response and recovery. It's about funding, but it's also really about staffing, right? And making sure that we have enough people, but also that we have the right people.
This has been a fascinating conversation. So how can people get in touch if they're interested in learning more about your work and emergency management in general?
I am on most social media platforms still. So it's Sam El Montano is where you can find me there. I also have a website, which is disaster-ology.com, which has like a ton of resources on it that you can check out if you want to learn more.
Samantha, thanks so much for having taken the time today.
Thanks for having me.